And now the game where we reward a lifetime of achievement with a few minutes of confusion. It's a game we call Not My Job. Starting as a songwriter at the famous Brill Building in New York City, going on to win 3 Oscars and endless gold records for songs like The Look of Love, Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head, What's It All About Alfie, dozens of others. Our guest today is without question the greatest living American composer of pop music, Mr. Burt Bacharach. Welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. So great to have you. I mean, there are.
It's a big intro. Thank you for that.
You're very welcome. It's true, though. It's true. It's true. We, you know, there's so many things to talk about in your career, but of course, maybe out of all the things you've done, arguably you're most well known for your movie music. So we were thinking in particular of one of your early hits. Here it is.
Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door, all around the wall.
That's, of course, The Blob. We don't think it was actually in the movie The Blob. It was sort of an homage.
You know, I think they may have put it in the movie. It was a song for hire. You know, that was, it became a little bit of a cult favorite. I was very happy to have any kind of hit song at that time.
So you were a young man then. Were you one of those people who grew up and knew from an early age you wanted to be a songwriter?
No, I wanted to be a football player.
Really? And did you ever get to try that? Did you ever get to go?
I was too small, you know, and I got beat up. And, you know, I had a dad who, you know, was all Southern Conference fullback. And he went to BMI and Virginia Military Institute. Yeah. That's where I wanted to go till I found out it was a military school.
You were like, oh, that's what the M stands for.
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Didn't want to go anymore.
Right. So then you said, okay, I mean, you must have been the only person who said, okay, my football career is closed to me.
I had not a clue. I was clueless what I wanted to do. My mother kept pounding piano lessons at me, and I must say that I hated it. I really, truly hated it.
So, for example, if say my daughters were listening, and they also didn't want to practice the piano, would you say that practicing the piano anyway would lead to a lifetime of riches and adventure and being able to marry Angie Dickinson? Would you say that to them right now?
I would not say that to them right now.
No. All right, let me ask you something, though, and this is important. Okay, so you never wanted to play the piano and she made you, or you wanted to play the piano but you didn't want to practice?
I didn't want to practice or play the piano.
Really? So what turned it around for you? What was it?
Well, you know, I think the most critical one maybe, Peter, was this. You know, like, at some time, my mother came in to the bedroom, my bedroom, and she was tucking me and putting me to bed. I must have been 24 at the time. No. Was I 14 or 15? Maybe something like that. And she sat on the bed and she said, listen, your dad and me, we've tried and pushed and got you a piano, got you a Steinway Grand, and, you know, our patience is out. It just doesn't seem you want to do this. So it's like your choice. You can stop right now if you want to stop. And I thought, this is incredible. This is what I've been waiting for. And I thought, I'm really free at last from this. She went out of the room, and I lay there for a while, and then was it Jewish guilt? I have no idea. Or just guilt from my mother, who worked so hard. And the next morning I said, no, I'll continue on. If it had not been for that moment, you know, and that decision, I wouldn't be talking to you now, would I? Really?
Well, maybe we'd be talking to you about your football career. You never know.
Yeah.
Wow. So that's what I'm supposed to say to my son about the cello?
Well, you know, I'm very lucky it turned out that way, but I still didn't think I had any ability or any talent. And there were just a couple of things that turned it around for me, you know, which was I heard some music that I liked for a change, you know. I used to go to 52nd Street in New York and with phony ID and just stand there and listen to these incredible musicians that felt like they were 40-year light years in front of anything I'd ever heard.
Wow. Yeah. Well, yeah. My son's 10. I can't get him a phony ID.
Well, let me ask you this. You, of course, started your partnership with the amazing Hal David, and you wrote Lord knows how many hit songs, hit after hit with Hal David, mainly sung by Dionne Warwick. And your music has since become sort of omnipresent. It's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. We were wondering, since we hear your music everywhere from the radio to the covers to elevators, where's the oddest place you've ever heard your own song?
Two things come to mind. One, before anybody knew what I looked like, because really composers are sort of anonymous. I hadn't married Angie yet, and hadn't won an Academy Award yet. Walking by the Hilton Hotel in London and past the doorman who was whistling Alfie.
No. Wow.
That's a pretty incredible feeling. Yeah.
Did you introduce yourself? Did you say, hey, you like that song?
Did you say, hey, I know what it's all about, Alfie?
Yeah, that's very good. Yeah. What a great lyric that is by Hal David. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, wow.
What's it all about, Alfie, yeah. But the other one was maybe like in a funny little bar in Italy along the coast, in the Amalfi Coast, hearing a piano player playing That's What Friends Are For, or trying to play it. Playing some wrong chords. But hey, anytime anybody's playing my music, live music, in a bar, even if they're mutilating it, to me it's a real form of flattery.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
4 or 5 years ago, my family and I went and took the tour of the LBJ Ranch in Texas.
Right.
And the last stop on the tour, you're on the tour bus, they have the pre-recorded thing. And because you couldn't get out of the bus because Lady Bird Johnson was still living on the ranch, so the Secret Service wouldn't let you get off the bus. So the pre-recorded thing would say, and now on our way back to the visitor center, we're going to play President Johnson's favorite song. And this is the song he listened to when the darkest days of Vietnam, when he was trying to soothe his soul in the great torments of his presidency. Dead silence. And then raindrops keep falling on my head.
That's great. I never knew that. That's a real story, right?
That's an absolutely true story. Because we're sitting there going, oh, Yellow Rose of Texas or, Dixie or something. And there's this wonderful little two beat in the tape. And then your song starts up.
Well, at moments like that, hearing something like that, if I hadn't been on the show, I never would have known this,
There you go.
Yeah.
It's a very informative show.
Well, Burt Bacharach, such a pleasure to have you with us. But we have, in fact, asked you here to play a game we're calling...
Oh, my God. I think I saw Leon Panetta for a second over by the punch bowl.
Barack Obama is planning on holding and attending at least 10 inaugural balls. And according to the Washington Post, at least, if history is any guide, not a single one of them will be any fun at all. I'm going to ask you three questions about the history of the inaugural ball. Get two questions right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice on their home answering machine. Carl, who is Burt Bacharach playing for?
Burt is playing for Lauren Collins of Atlanta, Georgia.
All right, ready to go?
Ready.
Here's your first question. Back in the day, inaugural balls were the most lavish affairs of Washington society. For example, at the 1893 inaugural ball for Grover Cleveland, guests would have enjoyed which of these amenities? Was it A, staff of 10 barbers to give free beard and hair trims to any male guest who wished for one? B, a 17-foot-high champagne fountain powered by a team of 6 servants taking turns in a bicycle pump? Or C, a reenactment of Washington crossing the Delaware in a specially constructed basin in the middle of the hall?
I like C.
You like C? You like the Washington crossing the Delaware?
Yeah.
Maybe every half hour on the half hour?
Yeah.
No, it was actually the barbers. They had 10 barbers. Anybody want to wander over and get a beard trim? You remember beards at the time, 1893.
Yeah.
Very big. Very
he was
big.
Bushy.
He was, it was a bushy period.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a little bit old, but I don't remember that time.
Yeah, I know. Not quite that. You didn't play it that way. No, that's cool. All right. You still have 2 more chances, and nobody cares if you win. Here we go.
I care.
Paula cares. Next question. Perhaps
I like to win.
Do you like? He like? We know this. Perhaps the first true disastrous inaugural ball was held in 1873 for President U.S. Grant's second term. What happened there? A, it was so-called the decorative caged canaries placed around the room all froze solid. B, the president, allegedly drunk, dropped his cigar into a tablecloth, causing a serious fire. Or C, a bad batch of milk led to widespread food poisoning among the Washington elite.
I think A.
You think A, it was so-called the decorative caged canaries all died.
Yeah.
You're right.
Oh, no.
Oh, wow. No.
They built a temporary structure to house the party, but they forgot to heat it, and it was 4 degrees outside.
Oh, my God.
It was a bad mistake. All right.
But luckily, the president got drunk and lit a tablecloth on fire, and they all thawed out.
This is so dramatic. You have one question to go. If you get this one, you win. Here we go. Modern balls have been known pretty much for their constant lack of fun. Maybe the worst single incident of modern balldom was in 1989, first President Bush's inaugural, an incident known in history as what? A, the Bastille Day coat check, in which a riot broke out as people fought for their coats. B, the great men's restroom dam collapse, in which the facilities were, shall we say, overstressed. Or C, the striptease from hell, in which a prominent Washington socialite bared her all after an ambassador stepped on her hem.
I like C, because I would have liked to have seen that happen.
Yes, wouldn't we all? I'm afraid it was A, the Bastille Day coat check. Some say, though, that the worst coat check disaster happened 4 years before at Reagan's second inaugural, when a woman from Texas lost an $8,000 fur in the scrum.
Wow.
Yeah. Don't go, people. Be happy you don't have an invitation. That's our message to you. Carl, how did Burt Bacharach do in our quiz?
Well, Burt needed at least two correct answers to win for Lauren Collins, but Burt had just one correct answer.
I'm sorry, Lauren.
Aww.
It's all right.
And after such a successful career.
I know.
Well, maybe you can make a lemonade out of this lemon. I mean, did any of these stories, the dead canaries, for example, would they inspire a song?
Not necessarily.
No. Burt Bacharach is a legendary award-winning songwriter. His new CD is Burt Bacharach Live at the Sydney Opera House. Burt Bacharach, thank you so much for being with us today. What a pleasure.
Raindrops are falling on my head, and just like the guy whose feet are too